Yeah, it's on.
Okay. Chapter 13.
Microphone muted.
And the word of Yahweh came unto me, saying, Son of man, prophesy against the prophets of Israel that prophesy. And say you unto them that prophesy out of their own hearts, Hear you the word of Yahweh. Thus says Yahweh God, Woe unto the foolish prophets that follow their own spirit and have seen nothing. O Israel, your prophets are like the foxes in the deserts. You have not gone up into the gaps, neither made up hedge for the house of Israel to stand in the battle in the day of Yahweh. They have seen vanity and lying divination, saying, Yahweh says, and Yahweh has not sent them. And they have made others the hope that they would confirm the word. Have you not seen a vain vision? And have you not spoken a lying divination? Whereas you say, Yahweh says it, albeit I have not spoken. Therefore, thus says Yahweh God, because you have spoken vanity and seen lies, therefore, behold, I am against you, says Yahweh God. And my hand shall be upon the prophets that see vanity and that divine lies. They shall not be in the assembly of my people, neither shall they be written in the writing of the house of Israel, neither shall they enter into the land of Israel. And you shall know that I am Yahweh God, because even because they have seduced my people, saying peace, and there was no peace. And one built up a wall, and lo, others daubed it with untempered mortar. Say unto them which daub it with untempered mortar, that it shall fall. There shall be an overflowing shower. And you, O great hailstones, shall fall, and a stormy wind shall rend it. Lo, when the wall is fallen, shall it not be said unto you, Where is the daubing wherewith you have daubed it? Therefore thus says Yahweh God, I will even rend it with a stormy wind in my fury, and there shall be an overflowing shower in my anger, and great hailstones in my fury to consume it. So will I break down the wall that you have daubed with untempered mortar, and bring it down to the ground, so that the foundation thereof shall be discovered, and it shall fall, and you shall be consumed in the midst thereof, and you shall know that I am Yahweh. Thus will I accomplish my wrath upon the wall, and upon them that have daubed it with untempered mortar, and will say unto you, The wall is no more, neither they that daubed it, to wit, the prophets of Israel which prophesy concerning Jerusalem, and which see visions of peace for her, and there is no peace, says Yahweh God. I can continue if you want.
Nah, this is probably a good place to start. I don't like getting too far ahead, because we'll just forget what we should discuss.
Sounds good.
First, the prophets at the end of chapter 12 were dismissing Ezekiel's prophecies, right? He was announcing doom upon the city, and they're like, oh, that's for times far off. That's not for now. He sees a vision that's going to happen a long time from now. So the prophets are always... False prophets are always soothing the people and making them feel good in their sin. I mean, we've seen the same pattern all throughout history, and it's startling today the extent to which they do that. So we see it today, and nothing's new under the sun. It was going on then. So now Yahweh's having Ezekiel rebuke these prophets that their visions are vain and the city is going to be destroyed. And where it says that they daub the wall with untempered mortar, it's really not referring to the wall literally. The wall's going to come down because the city's going to be taken. But it's really referring to the words of the prophets themselves and what they, the false prophets, are saying to the people. That's being compared to daubing a wall with untempered mortar, that it's going to fall. And I think that's about all I have to say right there.
I like how in the prophets we see that there were so many false prophets. And then in verse 9, Yahweh says that these false prophets, nothing of what they're saying is going to survive in their writing. And that's how it was. None of it survived.
Right.
If I'm reading that verse right.
And this is, there's another allegory, and I'm looking for it, but my hands aren't working properly. In Isaiah chapter 58, I remember this mostly because I did a podcast where Paul had cited this passage. And speaking about the reconciliation of the children of Israel in a prophecy of reconciliation. And Yahweh shall guide thee continually and satisfy thy soul in drought and make fat thy bones, and thou shalt be like a watered garden and like a spring of water whose waters fail not. And they that shall be of thee shall build the old waste places. Thou shalt raise the foundations up the foundations of many generations, and thou shalt be called the repairer of the breach, the restorer of paths to dwell in. That's not really talking about the actual builders. That's talking about the teachers that Yahweh would send to repair the breach between him and the people. So there, that building language is used in an allegory that's exactly similar to what we have here in Ezekiel 13.
Yeah, verse 5, ye have not gone up into the gaps, neither made up the hedge for the house of Israel to stand in the battle in the day of the Lord.
Exactly. Teaching the people the truth, you are acting as a wall of defense for the people, but they can only be defended if they accept that truth.
And often, like, false prophets sort of undermine the law of God. So the law of God, would you say, is like a wall around the people that protects them? It's like temporal salvation. If you keep the way of Yahweh, he will deliver you.
Yeah, well, that's what I was just going to say. That then that acts as a wall if you keep the will of God. So being a true prophet or a true minister or servant of God, you're going to teach the people the truth, and they will have that wall of protection. But these false prophets are daubing the wall with untempered mortar, meaning that it won't stick, it won't hold the blocks together.
I bet these false prophets were like, hey, if the Chaldeans come, don't worry, you'll be raptured. Don't worry.
Yeah, right. Right.
Where was the repairer of breach verse, Bill?
Isaiah 58:12.
So is that breach like
podcast it was, but it was one of my podcasts on Paul of Tarsus. Let me see if I could find it.
I think it might have been your one on Ephesians.
No, Philippians part 2. Repairers of the breach.
What were you going to ask about that, Noble? Repairers of the breach?
No, I was just suggesting it might have been Ephesians, but I was wrong.
I don't know why, but that podcast has 380,000 downloads.
Holy.
It may have been one of those podcasts that were attacked when people were evidently downloading my podcast maliciously. It could have been. I don't know. Most of the maliciously downloaded podcasts, I think, were on my front page. I don't know. But there were a few others that got an extraordinary amount of downloads, and that was one of them.
Would you all like me to continue?
Why not?
Okay, verse 17. Likewise, you, son of man, set your face against the daughters of your people, which prophesy out of their own heart, and prophesy you against them. And say, thus says Yahweh God, woe to the woman that sew pillows to all armholes, and make kerchiefs upon the head of every stature, to hunt souls. Will you hunt the souls of my people, and will you save the souls alive that come unto you? And will you pollute me among my people for handfuls of barley, and for pieces of bread, to slay the souls that should not die, and to save the souls alive that should not live, by your lying to my people that hear your lies? Wherefore, thus says Yahweh God, behold, I am against your pillows, wherewith you there hunt the souls to make them fly, and I will tear them from your arms and will let the souls go, even the souls that you hunt to make them fly. Your kerchiefs also will I tear, and deliver my people out of your hand, and they shall be no more in your hand to be hunted, and you shall know that I am Yahweh. Because with lies you have made the heart of the righteous sad, whom I have not made sad, and strengthened the hands of the wicked, that he should not return from his wicked way, by promising him life. Therefore you shall see no more vanity, nor divine divinations, for I will deliver my people out of your hand, and you shall know that I am Yahweh. End of chapter 13.
Yeah, there's some weird language here. I mean...
So pillows to all armholes. What's that mean, Bill?
Yeah. Now, the New American Standard Bible has so... And they add the word magic in italics, right? So magic bands on all wrists. But the Septuagint has, woe to the women that sew pillows under every elbow and make kerchiefs on the head of every stature to pervert souls. So something's going on there, and I don't know what it is. I really don't. It seems to be something worn, perhaps, maybe it is like a magic garment or a magic spell acted out in the wearing of certain accoutrements that gave the people what they thought was power to survive. I don't think so, right? But even the Douay Rheims, woe to them that sew cushions under every elbow and make pillows for the heads of every persons of every age to catch souls. And here it's to pervert souls in the Septuagint, or to hunt souls in the King James Version. And the word is a word that means hunt. So it's kind of strange.
Maybe it's like a pagan practice which has since been lost to time.
Well, that very well could be, because that's a problem with the Old Testament, is that we're missing so much historical context, right? Let me see if I could. Ezekiel 13:18.
I looked at some of the commentaries, and they don't have much besides, you know, it's some sort of pagan thing. They seem
Me that it's some sort of pagan, like, divination or incantation or something, because in verse 23, therefore ye shall see no more vanity, nor divine divinations, right? So it has to have something to do with divining or witchcraft or something like that. It has to, because that's the context, that there would be no more of this, and it's called divine divinations in verse 23. The NIV has magic charms on all their wrists instead of pillows, but I really can't blame them in the context. I mean, I would have to take a deeper study to language, but New English version. Magic bands upon all wrists. That word for pillows is a band or a fillet or a covered amulet. And they have false phylacteries here, which seems to me to be like just some Jewish interpretation, right? I wouldn't necessarily agree with that. Brown Driver Briggs has the word to mean a band or fillet, and they're worn on the head all the time. They're normal, and a cushion, bolster, or pillow. I would want to see those passages. Women sewing bands upon elbows. That's it. They were Nazi armbands. That's what they were sewing on. Okay, that was supposed to be a joke, right? I don't think we could really know exactly what this means, because like Noble said, there's some sort of historical context that's missing. Unless I would want to see every occasion where this word is used to see if it's ever used in such a context anywhere else, right? And maybe that would give greater understanding, and maybe it wouldn't.
This feels almost prophetic to me of all the women in our day, all those female pastors, and we know they can't teach if we read Paul, but whatever, the church doesn't care. All those female pastors who I think would have a stronger inclination to love universalism because women are at base emotional, empathetic. And verse 19, to slay the souls that should not die and to save the souls alive that should not live. Like, you know, oh, God loves you, Tyrone. It's like, oh, you racist, you're going to hell sort of thing. Really reminds me of that.
So I'm wondering if this had any signification in a pagan context that a certain individual was somehow justified. Like, oh yeah, he's okay, he's gonna live. We did a sacrifice for him. The gods told us he was gonna live. I mean, I'm just speculating.
Well, in two chapters, we have that famous verse, your like father was an Amorite, your mother was a Hittite. And maybe they're just saying to all those bastards in Jerusalem that like they can persist and continue.
And that's what verse 19 does insinuate. I agree.
Well, if they're using, sorry, Bill.
There's evidently people that should die that these false prophets are telling would live, right? But that could be in an Israelite context as well. So, but the bastards are definitely there. Ezekiel 16 corroborates Jeremiah chapter 2. I've often cross-referenced them.
We don't see many female prophets in the Bible, but I guess Yahweh does choose them sometimes. I know there's one in Kings Chronicles around there.
Well, it's Judges chapters 4 and 5, and I've used that to exemplify the feminism of Baruch, the fact that Deborah was a judge, and the fact that Baruch was a general and insisted on Deborah coming into battle with him. He's purposely putting a woman in a dangerous situation, and for that, Deborah told him, a woman will have his glory. And that was when Jael had driven the stake through the head of Sisera and killed the opposing general. So the woman got his glory. And that was a punishment for his feminism. And I believe that if we see women prophets, not always, but very often, it's a sign that the men of the period aren't doing what they should be doing. And that's... It seems to be true in that passage in Judges chapters 4 and 5 because Baruch was clearly a feminist. He needed his mommy with him out on a battlefield. He was a bitch.
Right, I agree, Bill.
I don't know if I have anything more to say about that's important to say here, but that make them fly is kind of weird too, because that really means to send out shoots or to blossom, but I guess it could be used allegorically to send out, to rush out of something, to shoot out of something, and here to shoot out of danger, right?
Would y'all like me to continue?
Please, because there's some language here that's just too obscure that, well, I don't have complete grip on. But there's no doubt that they strengthen the hands of the wicked, and they're prophesying that certain people are going to live that are definitely the sort that should die.
Okay, chapter 14. Then came certain of the elders of Israel unto me, and sat before me. And the word of Yahweh came unto me, saying, Son of man, these men have set up their idols in their heart, and put the stumbling block of their iniquity before their face. Should I be inquired of at all by them? Therefore speak unto them, and say unto them, Thus says Yahweh God, every man of the house of Israel that sets up his idols in his heart, and puts the stumbling block of his iniquity before his face, and comes to the prophet, I, Yahweh, will answer him that comes according to the multitude of his idols, that I may take the house of Israel in their own heart, because they are all estranged from me through their idols. Therefore say unto the house of Israel, Thus says Yahweh God, repent, and turn yourselves from your idols, and turn away your faces from all your abominations. For every one of the house of Israel, or of the stranger that sojourns in Israel, which separates himself from me, and sets up his idol in his heart, and puts the stumbling block of his iniquity before his face, and comes to a prophet to inquire of him concerning me, I, Yahweh, will answer him by myself, and I will set my face against that man, and will make him a sign and a proverb, and I will cut him off from the midst of my people, and you shall know that I am Yahweh. And if the prophet be deceived when he has spoken a thing, I, Yahweh, have deceived that prophet, and I will stretch out my hand upon him, and will destroy him from the midst of my people Israel. And they shall bear the punishment of their iniquity. The punishment of the prophet shall be even as the punishment of him that seeks unto him, that the house of Israel may go no more astray from me, neither be polluted any more with all their transgressions, but that they may be my people, and I may be their God, says Yahweh God. End of verse 11.
Well, that's pretty plain. I mean, the language is pretty plain. It's some people may take this as a thought crime and think that thought crimes are punished. We had that debate in the Christianity chat earlier. But no, this is clearly somebody that worships idols, that is engaging in idolatry. And doing that, they really have no business appealing to their God, appealing to Yahweh their God, because they've already turned their backs on him.
Right. So
basically using him as a talisman at that point, as a good luck charm.
Or just a member of their pantheon.
Right.
Should I continue?
Yes.
Verse 12. The word of Yahweh came again to me, saying, Son of man, when the land sins against me by trespassing grievously, then will I stretch out my hand upon it, and will break the staff of the bread thereof, and will send a famine upon it, and will cut off man and beast from it. Though these three men, Noah, Daniel, and Job, were in it, they should deliver but their own souls by their righteousness, says Yahweh God. If I cause noisome beasts to pass through the land, and they spoil it, so that it be desolate, that that though man may pass through because of the beasts, though these three men were in it, as I live, saith Yahweh God, they shall deliver neither son nor daughter. They only shall be delivered, but the land shall be desolate. Or if I bring a sword upon that land and say, sword, go through the land, so that I cut off man and beast from it. Though these three men were in it, as I live, says Yahweh God, they shall deliver neither son nor daughter, but they only shall be delivered themselves. Or if I send a pestilence into that land and pour out my fury upon it in blood, to cut off from it man and beast, though Noah, Daniel, and Job were in it, as I live, says Yahweh God, they shall deliver neither son nor daughter. They shall but deliver their own souls by their righteousness. For thus says Yahweh God, how much more when I send my four sword judgment upon Jerusalem, the sword and the famine, and the noisome beast and the pestilence, to cut off from it man and beast. Yet behold, therein shall be left a remnant that shall be brought forth, both sons and daughters. Behold, they shall come forth unto you, and you shall see their way and their doings, and you shall be comforted concerning the evil that I have brought upon Jerusalem, even concerning all that I have brought upon it. And they shall comfort you when you see their ways and their doings, and you shall know that I have not done without cause all that I have done in it, says Yahweh God. End of chapter 14.
Okay, here it still seems to be relatively early in Ezekiel's ministry. I believe the last time that we read a date in Ezekiel's ministry, it was only the sixth year. He started preaching in the fifth year of Jehoiachin's captivity, and I believe now it's the sixth year. And that was Ezekiel chapter 8, and we don't see the seventh year until Ezekiel chapter 20. So provided these chapters are in order, because some of the chapters in Ezekiel, in the later chapters, are certainly out of order, they're not in the correct order. Provided this is in the correct order, it's still very young in Ezekiel's ministry. Ezekiel and Daniel both went into captivity with Jehoiachin when he was taken to Babylon with the 10,000 princes or principal men of Jerusalem. So Daniel is still at this time a very young man. That this is, I don't know if we could know the precise year, but this is still in the 590s BC, and Daniel lives into the 530s. He lives for another 50 or 60 years after this, at least. So Daniel's still a very young man. But I believe that Daniel the prophet is the Daniel being referred to here. There is, however, an ancient Daniel who was respected, a respected seer, if you will, and he's mentioned in inscriptions hundreds of years before Ezekiel. Maybe 1,000 years before Ezekiel. And I read those inscriptions probably 20 years ago. And I don't really remember. It was a long, long time ago. But at that time, I was not convinced. And I was more convinced that that was not the Daniel being mentioned here, because it's highly probable, it's not certain, but it's highly probable that that Daniel was actually a Canaanite that's mentioned in those inscriptions. And I don't believe it's this Daniel. So I do believe that this Noah, Daniel, and Job, that this is the Daniel being referred to, and is the Daniel who's the prophet of the book of Daniel in our Bibles. He was already in Babylon, and he was already prophesying. If we pay attention to the book of Daniel and when Daniel had first prophesied, in that book of Nebuchadnezzar's vision and things like that, I believe Daniel chapter 2 It might be chapter 4. I'm going to go try to peek real quick. Right. Daniel's prophesying in the third year of Jehoiakim. That's when his writing begins. And that's basically when he first starts prophesying. That's the introduction to Daniel. And I believe that the events in Susanna may have even happened a little sooner, but I can't prove that. So in the second year of the reign of Nebuchadnezzar dreams, that's some years before what we see here in Ezekiel, before this time. So I really believe that this Daniel mentioned in this chapter is the Daniel, the prophet of the book of Daniel. And this is actually sort of, it's two things. First, it's a corroboration that the prophet Daniel did indeed live during the same time as Ezekiel at this very early time. And second, being mentioned along with Noah and Job, it's a testimony to Daniel's character. So even with these righteous men in Jerusalem, Noah, Daniel, and Job, they shall deliver neither son nor daughter. No matter how righteous the people in Jerusalem, any of the people in Jerusalem are, they're only going to save themselves through their righteousness. They're not going to be able to help or to deliver anyone else from this wrath which is going to come upon the city.
Is this different from the time of Lot? Because Moses, at the time of Lot, Moses said to the angel of God, you know, if there's 5 good men in the city, you know, will you destroy the whole city? It seems kind of different to that time.
Well, it is different than the time of Lot because not the entire city is corrupt. And I don't know if you were here or not when we covered Ezekiel chapter 9, and there was a portion of men in the city that Ezekiel was told to set a mark upon their foreheads, because those were the men that sigh and that cry for all the abominations that were done in the midst of the city. So there were evidently a lot of Lots in Jerusalem at this time. And that's exemplified in Daniel chapter 9.
Ezekiel 9, you mean?
Yes, Ezekiel chapter 9. I'm sorry. I got Daniel on my mind now.
Yeah. And you can see at verse 21, it says 4 sore judgments, and that's the sword, the famine, the noisome beast, and the pestilence, and to cut off from it man and beast. So you've got noisome beast versus a normal beast. So there's man and beast versus this noisome beast. So you can see that noisome beast is a punishment from God.
Yeah, but something tells me they weren't niggers.
What were they, Bill? Like wild animals, you reckon? Or so you reckon it's like wild beast versus like domesticated beast?
It seems to be, but these are bad or evil beasts. It could be dogs or rabid dogs or any other sort of pest animal bearing pestilence and acting savagely.
But today, you know, the noisome beasts probably are niggers and chinks, yeah, right, and the rest.
Right. I believe that.
It's like a shadow of things to come. And comfort, so he's speaking of the judgments, and he's talking, he calls it the evil that I have brought upon Jerusalem. So that shows that the evil that God does is actually righteous judgments, but evil in the sight of men.
Mm-hmm.
So like when people say, well, how Judeo say that, you know, Yahweh created good and evil. This is the evil that Yahweh created. Doesn't mean he created, you know, non-white devils or anything corrupt.
Or anything that's contrary to his law.
Yeah.
No, men can only blame themselves for that.
I think some CIolaters say the same thing too, like God created everything, even, you know, corrupt races that, you know, exist contrary to his law, and they'll use that verse, you know, I make light and I make dark, I make evil and good, but the evil is only righteous judgments. It's like your fate in the world is dependent on your willingness to follow God. And so if you stray from God, the evil that God's creating is those judgments that come upon you.
Right.
So it's evil you in better the follow him.
It's evil in the eyes of man, but not in his eyes. It's righteous judgment. I agree.
I really like verse 23, where Yahweh says, "And you shall know that I have not done without cause all that I have done." And I really feel like our people are going to learn that lesson in the kingdom.
Absolutely. Yeah, well, they're going to reflect that we have to take the lessons in this life with us so that we learn this lesson. Otherwise, it's all moot. Otherwise, there's no point. So yes, it's going to have to come to a time where people are able to look back and reflect on what happened to them and understand why.
Praise Yahweh.
Right, praise Yahweh. And there's probably going to be more to it than we could even imagine.
Oh yeah. I bet we'll learn stuff.
Right, of course. Like why a particular child died at 5 years old and things like
right,
that.
Right, right. And there's Down syndrome.
Why perfectly healthy men and women drop dead suddenly? Well, everybody's dying suddenly now.
Yeah.
Yeah, you don't want to try and judge God or his actions like some people do. Like they say, oh, why is there so much suffering in the world? How dare God do this to us? And then you get to the end of this life and it's like, you know, God knows everything and you tried to convict God and now you're seeing that he was righteous and just in everything he did. Yeah, that's true, Noble.
Actually blaspheming God, they're blaspheming him. Imagining him to be unjust. Oh, God, why did this happen? Why did you do this? This is wrong. This is wrong. No, it's not.
Why did he kill the Canaanites? I can't worship a racist God like that. Blah, blah, blah. And then you find out, oh, those Canaanites were actually, you know, like devil spawn. And he never even created them or intended them to corrupt his creation. Now what do you say?
Would you like me to continue?
Why not?
Okay, chapter 15. And the word of Yahweh came unto me, saying, Son of man, what is the vine tree more than any tree, or than a branch which is among the trees of the forest? Shall wood be taken thereof to do any work, or will men take a pin of it to hang any vessel thereon? Behold, it is cast into the fire for fuel. The fire devours both the ends of it, and the midst of it is burned. Is it meat for any work? Behold, when it was whole, it was meat for no work. How much less shall it be meat yet for any work, when the fire has devoured it, and it is burned? Therefore, thus says Yahweh God, as the vine tree among the trees of the forest, which I have given to the fire for fuel, so will I give the inhabitants of Jerusalem, and I will set my face against them. They shall go out from one fire, and another fire shall devour them. And you shall know that I am Yahweh when I set my face against them. And I will make the land desolate, because they have committed a trespass, says Yahweh God. End of chapter 15.
Sort of just a little parable, right?
Out of the frying pan and into the oven.
Right. The vine tree, what is a vine tree more than any tree? Because it wasn't highly esteemed. You can't take the wood from a vine to do any work. What do you do with a vine?
Swing from it like Tarzan, I guess.
I don't know. You really can't do much with them. I mean, you can't. Maybe you could make pulp and paper out of them, but that's not really all that useful in Ezekiel's time. They didn't make paper out of wood. They didn't have the process yet.
You know what I think? I think, you know, is a tear good for anything? Is a Jew good for anything? You know, what's a vine good for? And then we've got these bramble bushes. Is a bramble good for anything?
Yeah. Right.
So Jerusalem's being compared to the vine, and it's totally useless. And when it was holy, it was useless. And now it's only good to be burned.
And right. Would you say that's because the genetics have changed of Jerusalem, Bill? Would you go that far?
Well, yeah. Well, the genetics changed to a certain degree. They didn't change completely, but because it seems to me that the scum always rises to the top, the parable of the bramble bush. Well, whenever you have a city of any city in America or in Australia where you inject 5% Jews, within 20 years, the Jews are sitting in all the offices of administration of the city, and they're running it, and they own the banks. It doesn't take long for them to get there because they act like an organized crime ring. That's how they naturally act, and white people don't see it. And I'm sure Jerusalem was the same way. I'm sure it was no different in ancient Jerusalem. So the city became useless, and it just needed to be burned, like just about every city in the West today.
And so looking at this chapter, was a Jew good for anything before it was burned? And now that it's burned, you know, is it good for anything? Behold, when it was whole, it was meat for no work. So before it was even burned, it wasn't good for anything. How much less shall it be meat yet for any work when the fire hath devoured it and it is burned? You know, what's it good for? Nothing.
A corrupt city is good for nothing. Right.
In cross-referencing this to Jeremiah, I wholly planted you a noble vine, a noble plant. How have you become a degenerate plant before me? And they are now this degenerate plant. They're useless. And the chapter divisions are, of course, arbitrary. And in three verses, we have Yahweh say, your father was an Amorite and your mother a Hittite, which to me suggests that chapter 15 is a racial parable.
Yeah, without the chapter divisions, he goes straight into this. Son of man caused Jerusalem to know her abominations. And that comes off, I will make the land desolate because they have committed a trespass, saith Yahweh God. Well, what trespass is that? Okay, go to the next chapter. And it tells you, son of man, there you have it.
It almost seems like the division is purposeful. The poor division is purposeful because chapter 15 is 8 verses. Chapter 16 is 63 verses.
Oh, yeah.
Don't figure. Imagine that. 63 verses is like maybe 5 or 10 or 20 of those verses should have been with chapter 15. And then this verse about the abominations of Jerusalem and the fact that they were actually race mixing would be right in with the parable of the vine.
Yep.
So many Judeo-Christians, whenever I read a chapter in a prophet and I come to the beginning or to the end, I always check the chapters before and after to make sure that the chapter division doesn't really harm the context, or if I omit the chapter division, does it help clarify the context when I cite the passage? And this is definitely an instance where I would do that if I was citing the parable of the vine and wanted to talk about that. You would have to read these first few verses of Ezekiel 16. I'm sure many Judeo-Christians don't ever.
Yeah, it's like they compartmentalize every chapter. And so they just like read every chapter in isolation and never get it. It works.
They really compartmentalize every verse.
Yeah, they truly do. It's a huge stumbling block.
Absolutely. And it's an old... taken out of context. I'm sorry, out of context and put into any context that the speaker wants at a given time.
It's like they have a personal belief, and then they just find a Bible verse that supports that personal belief and then pretend it's come from God. So like, oh, I'm this sort of guy who just respects all people. I'm going to find a verse that seems to say that. And then, oh, now it's a holy verse and I'm a Christian, supposedly. You know, they think it comes from God because they've done that.
Absolutely. I agree. It's sad. But that's how they read the Bible. God only says one sentence at a time, sometimes two, never more, that are all a list of different sentences. None of them are connected. That's how they treat it very often. It's sad.
Yeah, I don't think there should be a division here.
No, there shouldn't. There may be a more proper division somewhere in chapter 16, but no, it shouldn't be here. Definitely not.
Would you like me to continue?
Yeah, sure, but I was looking through 16 looking for a better division. No, it's not important. Go ahead.
Chapter 16. Again the word of Yahweh came unto me, saying, Son of man, cause Jerusalem to know her abominations, and say, Thus says Yahweh God unto Jerusalem, Your birth and your nativity is of the land of Canaan. Your father was an Amorite, and your mother a Hittite. And as for your nativity, in the day you were born, your navel was not cut, neither were you washed in water to supple you. You were not salted at all, nor swaddled at all. No, I pitied you, to do any of these unto you, to have compassion upon you. But you were cast out in the open field, to the loathing of your person, in the day you were born. And when I passed by you, and saw you polluted in your own blood, I said unto you, when you were in your blood, live. Yes, I said unto you, when you were in your blood, live. I have caused you to multiply as the bud of the field, and you have increased and waxen great, and you are come to excellent ornaments. Your breasts are fashioned, and your hair is grown, whereas you were naked and bare. Now when I passed by you and looked upon you, behold, your time was the time of love, and I spread my skirt over you, and covered your nakedness. Yes, I swore unto you, and entered into a covenant with you, says Yahweh God, and you became mine. Then washed I you with water. Yes, I thoroughly washed away the blood from you, and I anointed you with oil. I clothed you also with broidered work, and shod you with badger skin, and I girded you about with fine linen, and I covered you with silk. I decked you also with ornaments, and I put bracelets upon your hands, and a chain on your neck, and I put a jewel on your forehead, and earrings in your ears, and a beautiful crown upon your head. Though you were decked with gold and silver, and your raiment was of fine linen, and silk, embroidered work, though you did eat fine flour, and honey and oil, and you were exceedingly beautiful, and you did prosper in it into a kingdom. And your renown went forth among the heathen for your beauty, for it was perfect through my comeliness, which I had put upon you, says Yahweh God. End of verse 14. I feel like there's a lot to say about these.
Yeah, this is... It seems to be like a reflection back, but I can't find the Exodus isn't that obvious. Sorry,
to me, it feels like Yahweh is recalling our whole story. Like, in the day you were born, your navel was not cut. Is that like, does that mean Adam? Like, of course, he didn't have a belly button. Is that what that is referring to? And then you grow up, you go through puberty. So the woman is growing up from Abraham, continuing as a people. And then he says he passes over them and he wants to marry them because they've come of age. And then that reminds me of Sinai. And he enters into a covenant and they become wealthy and they prosper and become a kingdom. And then we're about to go into the fornication.
But this is also very graphic sexual language. I spread my skirt over thee and covered thy nakedness. I swear unto thee and entered into a covenant with thee, and you became mine. And that's very graphic sexual innuendo to me in parts of that, where this is a husband-wife relationship, and then the husband takes the wife out, who he obtained when she was poor, and he dresses her all with nice clothes, and it's kind of normal for a man to do that to a bride. To want her to be in nice clothes and things like that. So this is definitely describing like a marriage relationship.
Yeah, I think it's Yahweh's marriage relationship with Israel. It's just from his point of view.
Right.
At verse 3, it sort of starts by saying thy birth and thy nativity is of Canaan. But then verse 4, it's going into before they were corrupted, and it's not until you get to verse 14 or 15 that it goes back into explaining why. So people would get confused by that, I reckon, because they would just follow along and they wouldn't get it that there's a contrast here between verse 3 and then from verse 4 and then back to verse 14 again or 15. There's a contrast, is what I mean.
Right, that seems to be the nexus point where it switches from the current situation to looking back in the past.
Oh, yeah.
Verse 6, where Yahweh says, I saw you squirming in your own blood, and I said to you, live. That sort of reminds me of all the times our race came close to extinction, and it was only through the will of Yahweh we continued.
Right, I would agree with that. And if it weren't for the call of Abraham, they would have been extinct, definitely.
What hope do you think Judeo-Christian would have of seeing that there's a contrast here between verses 3 and 4?
None. Nope, it's okay. All the Jews are Canaanites, that they're and they're God's chosen people. How about that?
They've got hardly any hope of getting a right message from this.
No.
Sad, sort of.
Should I continue?
Sure.
Verse 15. But you did trust in your own beauty and played the whore because of your renown and poured out your fornications on everyone that passed by. His it was. And of your garments you did take and deck your high places with divers colors, and played the harlot thereupon. The like thing shall not come, neither shall it be so. Thou hast also taken your fair jewels of my gold and of my silver, which I had given you, and made to yourself images of men, and did commit whoredom with them, and took your broidered garments and covered them, and you have set them oil, and have set my oil and my incense before them. My meat also, which I gave you, fine flour and oil and honey, wherewith I fed you, you have even set it before them for a sweet savor. And thus it was, says Yahweh God. Moreover, you have taken your sons and your daughters, whom you have borne unto me, and these have you sacrificed unto them to be devoured. Is this of your whoredoms a small matter, that you have slain my children and delivered them to cause them to pass through the fire for them? And in all your abominations and your whoredoms, you have not remembered the days of your youth, when you were naked and bare, and was polluted in your blood. And it came to pass, after all your wickedness, woe, woe unto you, says Yahweh God, that you have also built unto you an eminent place, and have made you a high place in every street. Though you have built your high place at every head of the way, and have made your beauty to be abhorred, and have opened your feet to everyone that passes by, and multiplied your whoredoms. Though you also committed fornication with the Egyptians, your neighbors, great of flesh, and have increased your whoredoms to provoke me to anger. Behold, therefore, I have stretched out my hand over you, and have diminished you ordinary food, and delivered you unto the will of them that hate you, the daughters of the Philistines, which are ashamed of your lewd way. Though you have played the whore also with the Assyrians, because you were unsatiable, yes, you also played the harlot with them, and you could not be satisfied. Though you moreover multiplied your fornication in the land of Canaan unto Chaldea, and yet you were not satisfied herewith. How weak is your heart, says Yahweh God, seeing you do all these things, the work of imperious, whorish woman. End of verse 30.
Well, this gets even more graphic. And let me say one thing, just a minor correction. Thou hast also is you have also. Not though you have, or I forget how you read it. I'm sorry. It's you have also. But this is even more graphic in verse 25, where it says, and hast opened thy feet to everyone that passed by. That means spread your legs to everyone that passed by. And that is pretty graphic language, but that's what it means.
Doesn't Yahweh say in this chapter, the emission is the emission of horses? Is that here?
I mean, it might be the regarding the Egyptians' great of flesh.
And that's even more graphic than the spreading your legs.
I'm not even sure if it's here. No, that's in Ezekiel 23.
Oh, okay.
And in my opinion, Ezekiel chapter 23, and I've discussed this in podcasts, is actually the divorce decree of Judah, even though it's not termed in that manner. And we'll see when we get there. Here in Ezekiel 16, that's right, that's graphic. And the emission of horses is just as, at least as graphic, and yes, possibly more, depending on one's point of view. We're talking about the woman, and then we're talking about her lovers and the emission of horses. It's also evident that what led to this was the proclivity of the children of Israel to trade with those nations and to have intercourse in mercantilism with those nations, and that leads to other sins and ultimately to sexual fornication with them.
Yeah, and Yahweh says over and over, my silver, my oil, my flax, just like he does in Hosea.
Right.
User entered your channel.
Look at China. China and Canada. China and America. And we've only been openly trading with China since Ronald Reagan in 1980. Now America is littered with Chinese, and they're all sleeping with Americans. All these white American servicemen with Oriental wives. They're all over the place here.
Men don't even have the foresight to see how that happens, Bill, because like they just think, oh yeah, we're just trading with them, and then the next day they're all sleeping with them, and men just think it's like just happened, magic. But God, that's why his laws are so long seeing, you know, that you can tell that his laws are divine because they can see so far into the future and protect you from these things that men just don't see. It's just incredible to me how they can just, we can just be trading with them 20 years ago, and then in our current time, they're all everywhere in our country, and men don't even realize.
Absolutely. And they're all over Florida here, and the whole South, from what I've seen recently. And I couldn't imagine seeing so many Orientals here 10 years ago. It's incredible. And there are so many American servicemen that are in, literally in bed with these Orientals, these Chinese, Koreans, Filipinos. It really is incredible that there's not going to be another generation of white servicemen in the Air Force in this country, or in the Navy too, apparently. Or maybe in any service. It seems like it's done.
It's like these Asian women are like succubus or succubi or something, Bill. They try and draw white men away like an evil spirit.
Yes, they do. And I really believe it's a program of communist China to do it purposely. That they're purposely sent here for that reason. I believe they're being sent here. They're not like just like migrating by chance or happenstance, that they're purposely being sent here with that intention, for that reason, to find themselves a white man to marry so that China can eventually rule over the West.
Microphone activated.
Well, you know what? They're actually, I'd say more of them are coming from Southeast Asia, those other countries, or at least those are more of the ones that white men are breeding with, because the Chinese are just even uglier than them, believe it or not. And that's what I find, like whether they're Cambodian or Vietnamese or all those fucked up countries down there, those are the ones that white guys are taking.
Whoa. Hey, Bill, what was
they
that guy's...
look like monkeys to me. I mean, I'm fascinated that any white man would even find them even marginally attractive. They're ugly as hell.
Hey, Bill, what was the big blonde-haired guy that had his own little trucking business? He used to come years ago. What was his name?
Are you talking about Bruce Gorman?
Yeah, Bruce Gorman. Didn't he kind of get tangled up with a little Oriental?
Yeah, and he hated me for it because he wouldn't separate himself from his group kids.
Okay, that's what I thought.
And hey, now Michael, he's dressed up like Hitler on Facebook. Mustache, the hair. He dyed his hair black so he'd look like Hitler. I swear. He's off the deep end.
That's sad. Hey, Bill, I use that Zella thing.
That is the fruits of being a race mixer. It really is. He deserves the punishment he's receiving.
So he's got the same attitude as Esau had.
He was an unrepentant race mixer. He hated me for telling him that if he wanted to please God, he had to separate himself from his bastard kids.
I don't know why that was so hard for him to do, because I've seen pictures of his kids and they're like little ugly mongrels. He should be like, look at it and just be like, I'm ashamed of that. And yeah, I will separate from them. I don't know why it was so hard for him.
He was bad enough for me on social media, so I plastered pictures of his wife and kids on Zogbots. Zogbots.org. I usually don't take credit for that site. I probably shouldn't.
Secret. Well, I like verse 30 here too. How weak is thine heart, saith Yahweh God, to do all these things? And he's right, of course, but just the way he says it, how weak must your heart be to even do these things? No faith whatsoever, I guess.
Well, right, because even if you're not taught that race mixing is evil in church, which I don't think any of us were taught in church or in school, you should still know in your heart that there's something wrong with it. But we have the same situation all over again today.
And in verse 20, Yahweh says, is this of your whoredoms a small matter? Which he's basically saying, do you really think this is like a small deal? This is huge.
Yeah, even if they weren't taught their stuff in school, they still made a choice to go along with the world. They're weak. A lot of these people who don't want to know the truth, they turn their backs on it, really, because they got a weak heart and they went along with the world. I think that's true. Like, you don't have to, you know, be taught this stuff necessarily. If you've got a strong heart, you would realize it is a weakness.
Well, this says the Egyptians are great as flesh, and I really wasn't impressed with the mortuary painting of the Egyptians getting their private parts washed by Negroes. They didn't exactly look like elephant trunks. I'm kind of being graphic, but I'm being real. But that's what it means. It's literally great of flesh. It really is.
Wait. So what does great of flesh mean?
I guess it means well endowed in this context.
Oh, okay. I didn't catch that at all.
If you ever saw that, it's kind of like made famous in right-wing social media circles. It's an actual painting from an Egyptian monument that shows Egyptians having themselves groomed below the waist by Negro servants or slaves. And it's a pretty graphic image.
Sounds pretty gay to me.
Well, I'm just making a joke about that, right? That they didn't look like they were so great of flesh. But here, they're actually literally being called great of flesh. Even in Greek, megalosarcus means great of flesh.
Wow, so the language here is so graphic, because right after the verse about spreading your legs, you have this.
Yeah, right. And that's part of my point, that this definitely plays into that. So it's, you can't, you know, people often deride me for sometimes using graphic language, but they don't understand that God used the same language when he had to make a point.
Right. Yeah, it's like taking someone and shaking them by the shoulders.
Right, exactly.
I don't get how people could read this and be like, it's a spiritual metaphor. It's so explicit, man.
Yeah, right. Spreading your legs to other nations with men that were great of flesh. I mean, come on, let's grow up. We're adults. Let's look at this for what it is and not just try to dismiss it and ignore the language. And this is the extent to which the children of Israel are committing whoredom. And this is how they're committing whoredom. By fornicating with the other races, the surrounding nations. And it's the same thing going on today. It's the same exact thing going on today. Every high place in the way, a church on every intersection is teaching race mixing today. So they made themselves a high place at every head of the way, which is every intersection. They have these temples. Well, we have churches today, and they're teaching that race mixing is permissible, and they're basically laying down and spreading their legs to everyone that passes by.
It's basically a brothel.
Yeah, this ain't happening in a brothel here. It's happening in a church, in a high place, a temple, if you will.
And in verse 27, the daughters of the Philistines, which are ashamed of your lewd way. And the Philistines were white, and they're like, whoa, Israel has gone off the rails. You know, they're like, whoa.
Well, right. But they were also pagans, the Philistines. So they were ashamed of the extent to which the people in Jerusalem were committing whoredom.
Wow.
it is shocking when you tie it all into today, like what Noble said about how churches today are like, oh, it's just a spiritual metaphor. There's nothing going on there. And then at the same time, they're saying that it's just a spiritual metaphor and blocking all that out. They're preaching, you know, race mixing and all these disgusting sins that the pagans of today would be ashamed of the Judeo-Christians. It's just that shocking, and you know, that they're so mixed up. You know, on one hand, they're saying, oh, it's just a spiritual metaphor. And on the other hand, they're promoting race mixing, and it would cause anyone to blush. But they're unashamed. It's just shocking.
Right. I would agree.
And usually when nations become wealthy, they become hedonistic, and he always starts this out by talking about their wealth. So the kingdom of Israel and Judah must have been very prosperous kingdoms, because they got so hedonistic, even the Philistines are like shocked, which I guess were a comparatively smaller nation.
Yes, they probably were by that time. I don't know if they were a comparatively smaller nation compared to just this remnant of Judah, because these are only the inhabitants of Jerusalem, perhaps about 100 years before this. Only the inhabitants of Jerusalem, for the most part, and Lachish were left behind. The Assyrians had taken everybody else, 46 fenced cities of Judah, into captivity. I don't think they took the cities of Lachish, the people of Lachish, because they had actually cooperated with the Assyrians. I know that there are famous inscriptions where the Assyrians are taking booty from Lachish, but I don't think that was the booty they took from Lachish. I think it was taken from the surrounding towns because they used Lachish as their base of operations while they were conquering the 46 fenced cities of Judah. So these people here are only the, for the most part, only the inhabitants of Jerusalem who were in Jerusalem and survived the siege in the days of Hezekiah. And they started to spread back out into the surrounding countryside in the time of Josiah. But they were still just a remnant of Judah. So I don't know if the Philistines were a much smaller population than that. It's kind of hard to gather. It's hard to figure. I don't think there's any way we could tell.
Nevertheless,
the Philistines were not all bastards, because in the prophet Zechariah, as part of the punishment decreed upon the Philistines, particularly in reference to Ashdod, it says, as part of their punishment, that a bastard shall live in Ashdod. And Zechariah is probably writing that 80 years after Ezekiel is writing this, maybe 70, but at least 70.
Right, because he was a prophet of the temple.
Yes, the rebuilt temple, the second temple.
Mm-hmm.
He's prophesying in 520 BC, or from about 520 BC.
This verse really hits me, how the Philistines are ashamed. Because like Israel had so much potential. They had the laws of Yahweh. They had God with them, and they fell so hard.
User disconnected from your channel.
You know, they fell. It took them a little longer to fall than the space of time between 1776 and today in America.
Right.
It's probably 350 years from the time of Solomon to this time, right here in Ezekiel. give or take a decade.
Should I continue, or do we want to stop here?
What, halfway through a chapter? You can't do that.
Okay, I'll keep going. All right. Verse 31. In that you build your eminent place in the head of every way, and make your high place in every street, and have not been as a harlot, in that you scorn hire, but as a wife that commits adultery, which takes strangers instead of her husband. They give gifts to all whores, but you give the gifts to all your lovers, and hire them, that they may come unto you on every side for your whoredom. And the contrary is in thee from other women in thy whoredoms, whereas none follow you to commit whoredoms, and in that you give a reward. And no reward is given unto you, therefore you are contrary. Wherefore, O harlot, hear the word of Yahweh. Thus says Yahweh God, because your filthiness was poured out and your nakedness discovered through your whoredoms with your lovers, and with all the idols of your abominations, and by the blood of your children, which you did give unto them. Behold, therefore, I will gather all your lovers, with whom you have taken pleasure, and all them that you have loved, with all them that you hast hated. I will even gather them round about against thee, and will discover your nakedness unto them, that they may see all thy nakedness. And I will judge thee, as women that break wedlock and shed blood are judged. And I will give thee blood and fury and jealousy. And I will also give thee into their hand, and they shall throw down your eminent place and shall break down your high places. They shall strip you also of your clothes and shall take your fair jewels and leave you naked and bare. They shall also bring up a company against you, and they shall stone you with stones and thrust you through with their swords, and they shall burn your houses with fire and execute judgments upon you in the sight of many women. And I will cause thee to cease from playing the harlot, and you also shall give no hire any more. So will I make my fury towards you to rest, and my jealousy shall depart from thee, and I will be quiet and will be no more angry, because you have not remembered the days of your youth, but have fretted me in all these things. Behold, therefore, I also will recompense your way upon your head, says Yahweh God, and you shall not commit this lewdness above all your abominations. I can continue if you want.
No, this is good.
All right.
I don't want to lose my thought here. Verses 31 and 32, where we started. Yeah, you know, it's kind of funny. Melissa and I, we go out to eat, and we'll see some mud shark sitting with some nigger at a table in a restaurant. And we always talk about it ahead of time. I'll bet the woman pays. I'll bet the woman pays. And she always pays.
Ha, right. I see where you're going with this.
The woman always buys the dinner for the nigger that she's with. They're giving the money to the niggers so that the niggers can be with them. And we see that all the time. And that's what it says here. The woman doesn't want to be hired for sex. She'll pay the husband. So they give gifts to all whores, but now that they give gifts to all whores, meaning men typically give a gift to a whore for her pleasures, right? But she is giving gifts to the men and hiring them, that they may come into thee on every side for thy whoredom. So we got threesomes and sixsomes and tensomes going.
Wow, right.
I mean, really. So and we see the same phenomenon today. I'm sorry we do, that these women are so desperate for a nigger that they'll buy the nigger's meals and let the nigger drive the car that her ex-husband's paying for, because they usually have nice cars, and we know the ex-husband's paying for it every single time. And they'll do anything to have the nigger. It's crazy. It's the same thing going on today.
Yeah, the nigger won't pay because it doesn't have any love or empathy in its heart. It just wants to use the other like a parasite. And
more often than not, the nigger probably doesn't even work.
So they're probably dirt poor, and there are misplaced altruism comes into play.
Yes. It's horrible.
Wow, this chapter has it all. I mean, first we have spreading your legs, and we have well-endowed. Now we have, like, orgies coming from every side.
Yeah, right. That's what it is. What else could it mean?
I think Ezekiel 16 is one of the Old Testament's, like, finest moments for proving, like, our entire argument.
That's probably very true. It really is. It's all about sex. It's not about idolatry. The church is trying, oh, that fornication is just a worship of false gods, of false idols. It's called fornication. And no bullshit. It's about laying down and spreading your legs for people of other races. That's what it's about. And it's very clear here. And it's clear enough in Jeremiah chapter 2. It's extremely clear here in Ezekiel 16. It just slaps them in the face. It just reaches up off the page and slaps them in the face. And I'll bet no church in America or anywhere in the West teaches on Ezekiel 16.
Oh, yeah. They probably avoid this. It's like, make sure the children aren't here. No, cover their ears.
And the children are the ones that need to hear it. Because the parents are already corrupt.
Mm-hmm.
And all these idols are universalist. So that, you know, Yahweh is a god of one people, but all the idols, any people can come to that idol and pay tribute. So when you start doing that, then you're starting to sleep with them, and that's exactly what's happening in the church. That's why they don't want to read this chapter about idolatry's connection to fornication and universalism.
All the blood of all the prophets, and I bet when Ezekiel was preaching this in the streets, they hated him.
Right.
Just like they hate CI.
I can continue if you want.
Sure.
Verse 44. Behold, everyone that uses proverbs shall use this proverb against thee, saying, as is the mother, so is her daughter. Thou art thy mother's daughter that loathes her husband and her children. And you are the sister of your sisters, which loathed their husbands and their children. Your mother was a Hittite, and your father an Amorite. And your elder sister is Samaria, she and her daughters that dwell at thy left hand, and thy younger sister that dwells at thy right hand is Sodom and her daughters. Yet hast thou not walked after their ways, nor done after their abominations. But as if that were a very little thing, thou wast corrupted more than they in all thy ways. As I live, says Yahweh God, Sodom your sister has not done, she nor her daughters, as you have done, you and your daughters. Behold, this was the iniquity of your sister Sodom, pride, fullness of bread, and abundance of idleness was in her and in her daughters. Neither did she strengthen the hand of the poor and needy. And they were haughty and committed abomination before me. Therefore I took them away as I saw good. Neither has Samaria committed half of your sins, but you have multiplied your abominations more than they, and have justified thy sisters in all your abominations which you have done. You also, which has judged thy sisters, bear your own shame for your sins that you have committed more abominable than they. They are more righteous than you. Yea, be thou confounded also, and bear your shame, in that you have justified your sisters. When I shall bring again their captivity, the captivity of Sodom and her daughters, and the captivity of Samaria and her daughters. Then will I bring again the captivity of thy captives in the midst of them, that you may bear their own shame and may be confounded in all that you have done, and that you are a comfort unto them. When thy sisters, Sodom and her daughters, shall return to their former estate, and Samaria and her daughters shall return to their former estate, then you and your daughters shall return to your former estate. For your sister Sodom was not mentioned by thy mouth in the day of your pride, before thy wickedness was discovered, as at the time of thy reproach, of the daughters of Syria and all that are around about her, the daughters of the Philistines, which despise you round about. You have borne your lewdness and your abominations, says Yahweh. For thus says Yahweh God, I will even deal with you as you have done, which have despised the oath in breaking the covenant. Nevertheless, I will remember my covenant with thee in the days of thy youth, and I will establish unto thee an everlasting covenant. Then you shall remember thy ways and be ashamed, when you shall receive thy sisters, thine elder and thy younger, and I will give them unto thee for daughters, but not by thy covenant. And I will establish my covenant with thee, and you shall know that I am Yahweh, that you may remember and be confounded, and never open your mouth any more because of thy shame, when I am pacified towards thee for all that you have done, says Yahweh God. End of chapter 16.
Well, Sodom was absolutely destroyed and completely destroyed by fire, right? Long before Israel existed or Judah existed. So this is only an allegory. Sodom isn't really related to Israel or Judah, except for the fact that she's being set next to Israel and Judah to exemplify the fact or the gravity of Judah's sins and the sins of Israel, how bad they were. They were even worse than Sodom. Now, was Sodom a Canaanite state? It's easy to assume so, but that may not be so, because the Sodomites, Sodom was actually, the region was a very cosmopolitan region. It may have been made up of Adamic people from many places, and probably along with some Canaanites. It really can't be told, because we're never told who dwelt at Sodom.
So at verse 55, where it says, Sodom shall return to their former estate, that could be because there were some Adamites there that Yahweh will restore?
That's what I'm thinking, yes. That's okay. What I'm thinking. And there's a lot of old school CI people that can't believe that Adamites could be corrupted in that way, that they had to be Canaanites, but that's not true. And we see corrupted Adamic people all throughout history. In Rome today, it's manifest over and over again.
At verse 45, it repeats that bit. Your mother was an Hittite and your father an Amorite. So that would be explaining that verse, so you can see the contrast, because it comes back to that. And it explains how your mother was a Hittite and your father an Amorite. It's because of these abominations. So you have to go all the way to here.
Perhaps also that explains the reason why there's so much iniquity. Because the children of Israel were told that if they accepted the Canaanites, that they would become like the Canaanites. That they would learn their abominations.
Even like the others, as Paul says in Ephesians.
Right. You were once children of sin, even like the others. Paraphrasing. I think his language is actually a little stronger.
I find it funny, considering how the word is used today, that Yahweh says, the iniquity of your sister Sodom, pride, is the first one.
Hey, Bill, I got a quick question that dovetails to this. It just popped in my head because my memory is not as good as it used to be. When it says that the children are eating the sour grapes and they go gnashing their teeth, is it the parents that gnash their teeth because of grieving over what their children are doing, or is it the children's teeth that are gnashing on the sour grapes?
Well, set on edge is what it says.
Set on edge, exactly. I forget if it's the children that are set on edge with the sour grapes, or if it's the parents that are set on edge because of what they're observing their kids do. Like, I see what's happening to this generation today.
And I think what it's saying is that where the children always suffered because of the sins of the parents, because the children were bastards, right? That it's saying that no more shall the children's teeth be set on edge, but every man shall die for his own iniquity. In other words, the parents are going to be punished for producing those children.
Okay. So then the parents would get a taste of the sour grapes also, the metaphor. Okay, and real quick, you guys, Bill, during that time going back, you know, 700 years or 510 years BC, did the Canaanites, or even during the time of the Judges and Joshua and Caleb, did the Canaanites, as far as appearance, look just like Adamites?
I mean, they would have looked similar, but I think that was the reason for the fornication. And we don't know really how similar they may have looked, because even though we know that generally the Canaanites were corrupt and that they were race mixed, they mixed with the Kenites, the Rephaim, and other people we can't even identify, which are mentioned in Genesis chapter 15, Genesis chapter 14, the Zuzims, who were just roving creatures. So they were mixed with those people, but we don't know to what extent.
See, like today, though, Bill, we can make go to a restaurant, make a distinction between a white family at a table and a group of mixed mamzers, you know, bastards. We can see that. We can see that. Well, maybe not always.
Hard to make a distinction.
Well, now, if I'm in Idaho or Central Nevada, east of Reno, like Yerington, it's all white. I go to a restaurant, I can't tell. I mean, they all look white to me. Go to Idaho, Montana, where my sister Gina lives now. It's as white as snow up there. You can't find.
Oh,
you
can't. There's some bastards up there. I know the synagogue's there.
Okay, but what I'm saying, Bill, is somebody like my sister or my cousin Dave, or even myself, just that don't have a deep knowledge like we have here in this chat. Most common white people, they're going to be they could tell the difference. Well, I'm in a white society here in Idaho and Montana versus in the hard downtown Reno, like where I live, there's no white people at all where I live. I mean, it's like a jungle here now. It's like a sewer.
Yeah, you know, there are whites and there are apparent whites that we believe may be whites, so we don't want to kick them to the curb just in case they are.
Right, but the common white person, though, Bill, that has a racial consciousness as far as living in a white community, like leaving the Bay Area and selling their home and moving to Idaho, they don't have the construct like we have conscientiously. They just look, okay, I go to Denny's and it's just as full of white people. I go to the hospital, everybody's white. That's how they look at it.
I bet that most of those people in California that are moving out of California, they're really not doing it for racial reasons. They're really only doing it for economic reasons.
You're correct there. You're correct on that point. I've only met a couple of old elderly people that have moved from California because of racial reasons. And they sold their Kelowna, beautiful German colonial home in Oakland that was built in 1910. They sold that for, I don't know, $2.5 million, almost $3 million, and got the hell out of there because it was a sewer. And Oakland's like Philadelphia. But I was just wondering. I didn't mean to ramble on. I just was wondering if...
Hey, Bill, couldn't the children's teeth be set on edge if it's like your father's, like, your countrymen started race mixing and now, you know, you're the current generation and you're surrounded by all these bastards, but you yourself are white. Like, that's sort of what's happened in our country. So now your teeth are set on edge because of what your the prior generation did. Could it be like that, like a generational meaning?
It's kind of difficult to determine because the phrase only appears in Jeremiah chapter 31 twice and in Ezekiel chapter 18 once. So Ezekiel chapter 18 verse 2, what do you mean that you use this proverb concerning the land of Israel, saying, the fathers have eaten sour grapes and the children's teeth have been set on edge? Or the children's teeth are set on edge. As I live, saith Yahweh God, you shall not have occasion anymore to use this proverb in Israel. Behold, all souls are mine, as the soul of the Father, so also the soul of the Son is mine. The soul that sins, it shall die. But if a man be just and does that which is lawful and right, and is not eaten upon the mountains, which is that fornication, neither has lifted up his eyes to the idols of the house of Israel, which is Baal worship and the like, neither has defiled his neighbor's wife, which is adultery, neither has come near to a menstruous woman, which is just morally repugnant, but it shouldn't be a problem downstream. And has not oppressed any, but has restored to the debtor his pledge, has spoiled none by violence. In other words, other grievous sins. And that man that has not done those things, it is rewarded, but, and it goes on and on and on. But basically, the fathers have eaten the sour grapes and the children's teeth have set on it. The children suffer for the sin to the father in one way or another. Well, now the man himself is going to be punished and not his children, it seems so. But then again, everybody's being punished because they're being taken into captivity. So we see Jeremiah chapter 31, the same thing, but it's talking about a far distant time in those days. Where Ezekiel is talking about a more immediate time and the punishment of Jerusalem in the immediate sense, Jeremiah is speaking of a far distant time when the new covenant is about to be consummated, in my opinion, which is actually the time that we're expecting today, the time we look forward to. So I really believe for that reason that Jeremiah, where the same phrase is used, it's referring to this time. The sour grapes, the best reference to sour grapes in the Old Testament, aside from these, are the grapes of Sodom, right?
The bitter, I think they're called bitter. That. Yeah.
I'm sorry?
I think they're called bitter in that.
Yes. I'll try to look for it.
I think it's in Deuteronomy.
Bitter or something.
Deuteronomy chapter 32. For their vine is the vine of Sodom and of the fields of Gomorrah. Their grapes of gall, their clusters are bitter. That reference is apropos because we see Sodom, the sins of Sodom being compared to the people of Jerusalem here, right? So that verse is fitting. That's a fitting cross-reference in this context to Ezekiel 18, which is two chapters from now, from where we're at. And it's speaking of the Canaanite nations. And we see those Canaanites among the Israelites here in Jerusalem.
So it's the same sin.
Yes, I believe so.
In verse 49, Yahweh says that Sodom's sins among pride are fullness of bread and abundance of idleness. So he doesn't mention sodomy there. So the fullness of bread, their gluttony, their greed, and their laziness, that was like the precursor to them becoming faggots and becoming degenerate, like their comfortable lifestyle.
Yes.
Okay.
And the ancient Greeks wrote about the same thing. That men that were wealthy and had luxuries became soft and effeminate.
Yeah, I think there's an old proverb, like sitting water gathers filth.
Idleness is the devil's workshop.
Right.
It's an old Judeo-Christian proverb, but it's quite true.
And then these final four verses of the chapter, I guess, are quite evidently prophetic of the new covenant. And it says in verse 61, "Then ye shall remember your ways and be ashamed, and ye shall receive your sisters, your elder and your younger, and I will give them unto thee for daughters, but not by your covenant." So I guess your covenant there is the old covenant. And is this prophetic of the fact that in the resurrection, these people in Jerusalem will be with the Israelites and even some of those who lived in Sodom? And because of them, they will remember their ways and be ashamed when they receive them and are judged according to their works. Is that what that is referring to?
Well, I believe so, because the Sodomites couldn't have been all Canaanites, right? I mean, Lot's daughters were never or accused of fornication. They were actually saved from Sodom. If they were fornicators, would they have been saved from Sodom? Their husbands weren't saved from Sodom. Their husbands were destroyed in Sodom, but the daughters weren't necessarily fornicators, so their husbands were probably Adamic and acceptable.
And Christ also says in the Gospels, like, that your day of judgment, like Tyros and Sidon, you know, will be worse than the judgment for Sodom. So that means that the people of Sodom will be resurrected and judged, doesn't it?
It seems to infer that, yes. And I thought it was Chorazin and Bethsaida, but he may have said it.
Okay, yeah. I think he also says it about Tyros and Sidon, because I just did a Matthew audiobook for your CNT, and he does say that.
Okay, that's fine.
Unless I'm remembering
wrong. The other passage.
So that is verse 61. That is prophetic of the resurrection and being judged according to your works, then.
It seems to me that it is, yes.
And says, "You shall remember your ways and be ashamed." You could cross-reference that to Daniel chapter 12, verse 2, like eternal shame.
Yes, that everlasting contempt of Daniel 12.
Okay, thank you.
It's Chorazin and Bethsaida, but it also mentions Tyre and Sidon.
Matthew, okay, so it's all four.
Matthew 11 from verse 21.
So we're both right.
He said, if the works had been done in Tyre and Sidon that were done in you, referring to Chorazin and Bethsaida, yes. And then he says something very similar to, that's same passage, I'm sorry. Mark 6. It's a little different in Mark 6. I'm not clear whether or not it's the same exact recollection or not. I'd have to see the greater context.
And since these last verses are prophetic of the kingdom and the resurrection, verse 63, "that you may remember and be confounded and never open your mouth anymore because of your shame." That really reminds me of every knee will bow and every tongue will confess, and that there will be complete obedience in the kingdom.
Right, there must be. That's the promise of God. It's a promise of God.
Never open your mouth anymore. And Jude, right, he writes, "Behold, the prince comes to convict everyone of every impious word they have spoken against him." And then here in Ezekiel, Yahweh's like, "You will never again open your mouth against me."
At Romans 3:19, it says, "Now we know that what things soever the law saith, it saith to them who are under the law, that every mouth may be stopped and all the world may become guilty before God."
Right.
And that is a great cross-reference for Ezekiel 16:63.
Paul had to get it from somewhere.
Paul was so smart, eh?
Oh, yeah, it's crazy.
Yeah, Paul was good. I have no idea how the Paul bashers even get to where the fuck they are. It's incomprehensible to me.
I blame the translators of the KJV and other popular translations.
Oh, yeah, the translations are bad. Yeah, that's true. I'm sorry. But I don't know. The context of Paul is all about the children of Israel, the 12 tribes of Israel. He's being persecuted for his ministry to the 12 tribes, as he explains to Herod. So how do you figure when you go read all men that he means beggars and chains? I mean, it's incomprehensible. If you actually read all of Paul, you can't imagine that. Unless you want to for some agenda. The Paul bashers are just incredible to me.
It's natural in your own language that, like, when you're talking about, you know, use a certain context, like if you say all men are required to sign up for the army, you know that means, like, or I'm in Australia, that means all Australian men. You know, you just automatically know that.
Right. And I don't know how they imagine Paul to have been speaking any differently.
Yeah, I got into a little bit of a debate. I don't want to say it got heated because I was respectful to, because he was older than me, with James Bergerman on this issue. And they portray Paul as a universal. And they try to use Ephesians. I believe they make a demarcation between the Ephesians and the children of Israel and talk about those that by faith accept the gospel. This is Bergerman's view. And then they also say Israel, God uses Israel to teach the rest of red, yellow, black, and brown to submit to God's law. And they go to Isaiah for that. And the way they universalize Paul, James Bergerman and Stephen Jones. And yeah, believe it,
nigger lovers, and I would not have been so polite.
Well, the thing was, at least Darla, on two issues, Darla took my side, Stephen Jones's wife. She said, Michael, I see your point. You know, I never saw this before on a tithing issue and then on this other issue. You know, on the universalization of the passages, and they all say Paul was a universalist because of the way Paul writes Romans 5. I said, but you're taking Romans 5, the way it's broken up in chapter verses, you're taking it out of context. Paul wasn't talking about the planet or the globe and all the two-legged hominids. And then they go to Romans 11:15. If it wasn't for the casting down of Israel, for the reconciliation of the world. So they universalize Paul. They put universalism in Paul's mind. That's how they teach it.
Okay, I know I've addressed all that.
I just came to my mind. One other thing real quick, Bill. Two questions. Yeah, real quick. You know, Joel Osteen. Back in 1978, I met his dad one time at a conference. I just went with my father. He wanted to go. It was a full gospel businessman's fellowship. And I just went along, and he was there, and I met him and shook his hand. Well, at that time, I didn't know he was married to a Jewess. Well, she's dark-skinned, coal black hair, and that's where the son Joel gets his Jew, the Canaanite blood in him, from his mother, not from his dad. His dad is as white as you and I, John Osteen, who's dead now.
Okay,
but I just thought I'd share that. And the other thing, Bill, did you see my email come through on the Zella deal?
The what deal?
The Zella on my U.S. bank?
Yeah.
Because it went, okay. Now I know how to do it now. All right. I'm going to put another one in probably tonight or tomorrow.
Thank you, Michael. Martin showed up. Amazing.
Martin's a busy... Martin's a busy man. He's got a lot on his plate right now, brother.
I'm sure. Pizza, Subway.
No, no. I just went to Popeyes and had some soup.
I was talking about Martin's plate.
I know Martin's probably got fruits and vegetables, right?
Martin don't do fruit and vegetables unless they're on a on a steak pizza with lots of peppers and onions.
Yeah, and extra mayonnaise.
I've been picking on Martin about the same thing for about 8 years now, maybe six, maybe seven.
Hey, David, are you there? Hello, David. Still recording.
Oh, Dave.
He's still recording, but he passed out.
Yeah, he's asleep.
Let me call him. Hold on a
second. You just wake him up. Leave him alone.
Yeah, the recording will stop eventually.
Let him sleep.
I can't stop the recording for him. I wish I could.
You know what we should do? Just ban him and then let him back. I'm gonna kick client from server.
You were moved. You were moved.